Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela. Thank you for joining us today for the podcast. I'm here with John and Jim.
Hey, everyone, this is John.
Hi there, this is Jim.
So today we're going to talk about one of the hardest parts of our profession. I think you've all been out and people ask you what you do and you say you represent children in child welfare cases or however you say that. And the most common question we get is, I don't know how you sleep at night.
And then the conversation ends and they walk away.
And you move on. But really, it's actually a valid question. You know, what is it that we can do as children's lawyers to not only to sleep at night, but to be able to end our work day and transition to our families without this heavy burden? It's part of not getting burnt out, but it's also part of keeping kids safe. And so today we wanted to take on this very difficult topic, but to give you some strategies that you can use.
Because it is the hardest. It's what elicits the groan from the people at a party when they ask you what you do, is that their context for child welfare is the high-profile cases that make the news, the horribly tragic outcomes, that if you do this work long enough, unfortunately, you may encounter. I mean, we're in this profession because, unfortunately, people do bad things to children sometimes, and it can happen, and it may very well happen on your caseload someday. And so, hence the title of this podcast, how to sleep at night. And we want to just give you three quick strategies. It's not a comprehensive list, but we think it helps to somewhat insulate you from the stress and anxiety that comes with this profession.
And the important thing about developing these strategies, the overarching idea here is to develop a process, a process to address the most significant dangers to the child.
Not a bureaucratic process, right? We're not talking about some kind of bureaucratic paper process.
No. It's got to be a process that works for you, realistically, within your caseload. But it has to be a process that you follow that is substantive, and that if you follow it, you know that you have done your due diligence, and if something terrible to happen to one of your clients, you know that going back in time, you would have made the same decisions, followed the same process, because you've checked around every corner you could check in a child welfare case to make sure that the safety concern has been addressed. So that's what we're talking about here, is developing your own process that you follow, and you're secure in knowing that you've done what you need to do.
And I just want to reiterate that it will look different for every lawyer based on, as Jim mentioned, your caseload, but maybe your judge, maybe the case manager you work with regularly. It has to be very specific and tailored. And so what we thought we would do today is share a few of the things that are part of our process to get you started.
Right. Yeah, these are three very basic but very important things over time we found have helped us keep kids safe.
This first one sounds pretty basic. It's basically, read the home studies. Home studies are the document, of course, that's going to tell you initially what the safety issues are in that home, or if there are any, and whether it's going to be safe for the child to be there. So you have to read them and read them with a critical eye, looking for what's said in there and what is unsaid, what's done in the home study and what is not done. It should be a process among your agency to fingerprint anyone or background check anyone who's going to be in the home. So you want to look for those things. You'll see the list of who's going to be in the home. Have they all been fingerprinted? Have they all been background checked? So you've got to read it looking, almost visualizing the home too. Are there guns in the home? If there's guns in the home, are they locked in a cabinet? You know, are they locked securely away? If there's a swimming pool, is there a fence? These are the things you have to think about when you're reading a home study. You have to think in terms of danger, in terms of liability, take yourself back to your torts class and start thinking in terms of liability and the potential dangers of risk down the track.
This is where your critical thinking skills that you picked up in law school are going to come into play and benefit your client. So if your client is going to a home with a young aunt who already has a couple children, ask the simple question of yourself, where's the frequent visitor? You know, where's the boyfriend? Maybe aunt doesn't have a boyfriend. Maybe she doesn't. But, you know, that's one thing that gets overlooked so often, and then children get placed in relative or non-relative placement. Something bad happens. It's not, sometimes it's not the caretaker, right? It's the person visiting the home. Frequent visitors are supposed to be checked out in many jurisdictions. And it's just, really, it's just as simple. I mean, in a child death case, I've been asked by members of the judiciary, had you guys been on this case, would you have done anything? What would you have done? And would it have helped prevent this tragic outcome? And I've looked over the facts and I said, yeah, we would have read the home study. And they were like, oh, and you would have brought it to our attention. That's why we need kids' attorneys, because you would have brought this to our attention, and then the judges could have intervened and we would have known and saved this life. And I'm like, well, yes and no. I said, I wouldn't have brought it to your attention. I literally would have picked up the phone and called my colleague, the agency for the state, and said, hey, have you read the home study that you filed with the court? And I've had these conversations in the past. Look at page 8. And I get back, oh, thanks, John. Thank you. Okay, we'll take care of that. And then it's either fixed or further investigated, or the child doesn't go there. These days, some of the problems are so basic, you don't need to litigate these. You just need to read and pick up the phone. Because like Jim said, this is a very basic one. But again, if you've read the home study, then and it checks all the boxes and it looks safe, at least you've done it. It's not your job to go out to the house and look under the bed. That's not what we're saying. But read that document, make sure it's thorough and complete.
Well, and I think it is basic, but it is also nuanced, because what we're saying is it's not just reading who's there. It's making sure that everyone, you know, that all the players are identified, such as if there's no boyfriend, making sure there isn't one. And it's really focused around who's in the home.
Yes.
All right. So, John, what's another strategy?
Well, this is a big one. This is, to me, this is difficult. And it's one that a lot of newer attorneys fall into, and I myself fell into this one. Do not ever sign off on what we're going to call a bad case plan. And by a bad case plan, we mean a case plan that does not really address the real risk to the child. So, for example, you can have a dirty house case, but also an allegation of some type of sexual touching of the child, which looks difficult, if not impossible, to prove. So to consent, to get past a messy, really difficult trial, maybe the defense attorney will propose that we strike that language of that allegation that you can't really prove, and let's just give them a case plan for the dirty house and move on. And I've seen this happen numerous times. And then you come to the point where the parents have complied with the case plan and you don't have a legal argument to protect that child, but you really think that something happened and you didn't take an opportunity to prove it. We can't bring cases that are not brought in good faith. You have to have a good faith basis for your case. However, you're also not supposed to hide the ball from the judge or the finder of fact. So the judge is the one who's getting paid to make these findings. So take a case to trial and give the judge the evidence and let the judge decide whether or not that petition should be granted or dismissed. This is much more difficult than the first one, right? Because you're left sometimes with the analysis of, gosh, if I go to trial and flat out lose, there's no protections for the child. If I settle, I at least get supervision. I kick the can down the road. I can keep this guy out of the home for 6 months. Maybe something will come up in the interim, some new evidence. So this one is more nuanced.
I was just going to say, this is very nuanced. This is one I get into with our attorneys on a case-by-case basis. Because if you're not getting everything you want, but if you can get like an assessment of the parent where you know the assessment's going to turn over that rock and find the true problem, that's a possible way to go. And there's a legal theory or a legal strategy at least to go with a bad case plan. But like you said, it's usually these bad case plans, we're not saying there are bad lawyers entering them. There are lawyers making decisions based on the weaknesses of their case.
Well, said another way, a bad case plan is a case plan that doesn't address the biggest risk to the child. right?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to define here. And when we're in the context of what we're talking about here today, which is preventing the tragic outcome, I guess if you're going to go down that road strategically, do it strategically, do it intentionally, and try to develop an exit strategy where you do address that safety concern down the road. So if you have to concede something up front just to get that adjudication of dependency and get that case plan approved, try to attack that safety problem, like Jim said, from another angle. Like, maybe I can get a biopsychosocial assessment of this guy, which will lead to, ooh, he needs a psychosexual evaluation, which will lead to being able to amend the case plan, perhaps, in your jurisdiction. Have a strategy for that. But don't, like I said, hide the ball from the judge, because if you need to throw it out there and let it be known, because there have been a lot of tragic outcomes where when they do the postmortem on the case, you look at it and you go, oh, yeah, that everyone knew, but nobody wanted to address it because maybe there were good faith proof problems, or maybe it just was going to be a really difficult road and they took the path of least resistance. So there's a difference there, and it is nuanced.
It's a difficult situation. I remember the line from A Few Good Men, the movie, if you haven't seen it, check it out. Tom Cruise says, it doesn't matter, I'm paraphrasing here, it doesn't matter what's true, all that matters is what I can prove. Not necessarily true in a dependency case, though. What matters is what is true. And so if you know truly that there's some greater danger there, then you have to somehow try to negotiate a way to it. And it's very tricky. But when you sign on to a bad case plan or settle a case with a bad set of facts, the finding of facts become the narrative for that case now. They become the new reality. And so often that's in our favor. You've got the findings of fact on paper, and the parents can no longer deny them because that's the new reality they're living under. They're addressing problems that they never agreed they really had, but they agreed to the findings of fact. So now you're the one agreeing to a findings of fact that are divorced from reality, and that can be a major safety problem for your client.
And I don't believe the judges in our juvenile judges in this nation want practitioners hiding the ball in that way. They would rather, you know what, throw it to the judge. And if the judge is uncomfortable, the judge can throw it to the fourth, or I'm sorry, the fourth, I'm using my district court of appeal. The judge can throw it to the appellate court and say, hey, you don't like my finding, you can reverse me, you know. But that's what they're there for, is to make findings of fact. Somewhat related, right, to the case planning, to the bad case plan, and is the compliance issue.
Yeah. So the third strategy that we wanted to share is around, I think you've all heard this phrase, trust but verify, and I think we would define it a little differently. It would be don't trust and verify.
Right. It's so important when you're dealing further down the road in a case, when parents are trying to get their act together, they're coming forward with proof that they've complied, but maybe you want to really dig in to make sure that there's been some substantive change. You don't want to just accept certificates or the word of case management that the parents are ready for unification. You'll see a certain momentum building towards it. You'll see visitation start to increase, and sometimes that's a boulder that just starts rolling down a hill. Once unsupervised visits start in our jurisdiction, there's a certain momentum towards overnights, towards weekends, towards reunification that is in play, and sometimes you've got to have to slow things down. And that's why today, when we're talking about safety, we've got a different tone than when we're talking about urgency and speed, like we usually are. We're talking about the speed we need to get kids home quickly. But this is where we have to slow our roll when we're talking about safety. And that's the job of the children's attorney, to pump the brakes sometimes. And when you're trying to verify compliance with a case plan, it's more than just a paper trail. The paper trail is important because those are the little signposts along the way that tell you that things are done. But it's very important to have that information from the provider that there's been substantive change for the reason for removal, for the issue that presents the danger to the child. That's the one item you're looking for substantive change on. Whether they've completed a parenting class is, generally speaking, not something you need to talk to the parenting provider about. Unless you're dealing with that specific issue on a case, that's kind of like the add-on task. But if it's a substance abuse case, you need to talk to that substance abuse provider. If it's domestic violence, you need to talk to that provider and say, have you seen behavioral change?
Right. And along those lines, I've done that, right? I've had a bad domestic violence case where I called the provider who discharged the perpetrator of the violence after six sessions. And I said, well, how did he do on like, did you work with him on his anger management? And the response was, well, he didn't seem angry to me. And I thought, well, you know, maybe you should marry him and move in with him and then cheat on him and see how he treats you. You know, maybe you could expose the anger that way, since six sessions obviously wasn't enough to do it. I think there's also here, and this might be a little overwhelming to some practitioners, because it's hard to get these documents. It's hard to get these providers on the phone. Most of these providers are not forensic in nature. They don't want to talk to attorneys. They do not want to testify. They would rather almost quit their jobs than testify in some cases. There's another way to verify compliance and substantive change, in addition to what you're talking about, is you're looking for behavioral change in the parents. And sometimes you can see that in how frequently they're visiting, how they're behaving at visits. Are they still with the person who they were with when they were doing whatever presented the problem in the first place? You know, case managers who are with these parents a lot will tell you, oh, they're different. Oh, they're so much more responsive now. You know, they're not cursing me out all the time anymore. They're actually grateful for that we were intervened in their lives now. They can see, they've developed some insight. Those are also helpful things that you can document. But our basic message here is don't trust those certificates. Verify compliance by real change.
I think this kind of goes to, I think it was Judge Bernstein that brought this up when we were talking about bias in a former episode, but these should not be emotional decisions. It's a court of law. These need to be based on fact. And all of these three strategies that we're sharing for you are really based on making sure you get to the truth.
Right. We want you to develop these practices. I've tried to develop these practices almost as muscle memories in a case, just habits that kick in automatically. When you're first starting to do it, it's kind of good to, it's a little morbid, but it's kind of good to almost pretend you're doing a postmortem on the case where something tragic has happened and you're opening your file now to see, and you're hoping to see a thorough job. You're hoping to see, was I lazy? Did I miss something? Did I not have time to read that home study? Did I kind of ignore that one task because no one wanted to litigate it? And I didn't want to bring the grandmother in to testify that mom had substance abuse problems. You know, she might have been a witness for that, maybe the only one, but I should have brought her in and fell on my sword, maybe won or lost on that issue. You don't want to have those things that you didn't follow. So it's sometimes good to pretend you're doing a postmortem on a case and looking for your due diligence.
And we're, you know, as lawyers, we're trained to be critical thinkers. And honestly, we're trained to think in terms of liability, right? I mean, you come out of law school and suddenly you've got this liability lens. And it's actually very helpful to use that lens to keep kids safe. I think our whole message here is that if you develop your own personal style and process that you follow and it becomes muscle memory, then you will be able to sleep at night and thrive in this profession and not burn out as quickly.
And to wrap it up, really, we do put out there a lot of strategies to prevent undue delay and to move cases forward. And that's, you know, True North Advocacy is about getting kids home as quickly as possible. But we wanted to just pause and address a little bit of the safety piece that is always on our minds as professionals. And we hope this has been helpful for you, and we thank you for listening. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.